It's got a death curse.
So it's father would be like me.
And then he'll lock you up in a cellar.
Just like having a wart removed.
What's the boogeyman?
As a matter of fact, it was.
Last time we covered William Lustig's Maniac in the incredible remake made by Frank Calhoun. At the end of that show, we had Mr. Lustig admit during an interview that we found that he and Joe Spinell were probably influenced to include mannequins in their story by a film called Tourist Trap. And once I heard that, I knew exactly what we were going to do for our 25th show. It's time for Horror 101 to bring another hidden gem out into the light. I remember very vividly being 8 years old and turning on the Thriller double feature one Saturday afternoon and catching the end of a film that completely terrified me. I remember as if it was yesterday watching an old man sit cackling in his armchair as these animated mannequins terrorize and kill this young lady. It would be some years later before I knew that I had then stumbled onto David Schmoller's Tourist Trap. And tonight we're going to revisit this film in the usual Horror 101 fashion, except this time we've got something special planned for you. Mr. Schmoller agreed to let us call him while the microphone was running, so during this show we'll have excerpts from that interview for you. Exciting times here at Horror 101. With me tonight is the world-famous Brian Stewart, the cult sensation Nick McPherson, my wife the lovely nude, and the nefarious Paul B.
The man is nefarious.
So, Tourist Trap, you've seen it?
I believe so. Because this is a Channel 20...
Yes.
Channel 20, Channel 50 kind of movie. I believe I've seen it.
It was made in 1979. Basically, these kids go for a drive, they arrive at this... They go swimming at this lake, they meet this old man, and the fit hits the shan. Almost sounds like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but it's not. There's elements of, like, it's almost like somebody took these elements from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, these elements from Psycho, and these elements from Carrie, rolled them all up into a ball and gave us Tourist Trap. And as far as Horror 101 goes, I always wanted to focus on the great films that a lot of people haven't seen because for some reason or another they've been glossed over, and I think Tourist Trap is the ultimate example of the kind of film that we should be doing. I always kind of wanted to do this one, and after doing Maniac, I'm like, you know what, fuck it, we're doing it.
The one element that stands out in Tourist Trap is the telekinesis. It's bad enough being stalked by a villain brandishing a sharp object. You can possibly get away from that, but a killer with the ability to move and alter reality? There's a frightening scenario.
Have you ever seen another character that could move things with their mind?
Well, my favorite Friday the 13th, Part 7.
But that was a hero.
A New Blood. Yeah, the hero had telekinesis and was able to take on this stalwart Jason.
But have you ever seen another villain who'd done that? You'd think it would be a more exploitable power.
Nothing outside of something completely paranormal like Poltergeist, where it's all energy.
Or maybe Pinhead with his chains.
You're talking like... How many villains have been like humans or humanoids that have had this kind of power? Posthumously, the guy in One Dark Night, you remember that one with Meg Tilly?
Where they
spend the night. These teenage girls getting caught in this mausoleum where his body is, and he's still got these powers even after death. So that I would give you.
I would say the tall man in a certain element.
Phantasm, I mean, but basically Phantasm is a sci-fi movie because he's an alien.
There are other horror films that use telekinesis as a plot device. David Cronenberg's Scanners is probably the biggest example. Of course, you also have Carrie, The Fury, Firestarter, Phenomena. It's an aspect that has been exercised, but there's something about its use in Tourist Trap that's more terrifying than awesome.
And that's the joy of Tourist Trap. It's very original. It's very claustrophobic. I know you don't like claustrophobia.
Shut up.
It's very claustrophobic.
I am claustrophobic.
It's very creepy. It's one of those movies, like, it's campy and it's creepy. It's fun.
If it's the same film I'm thinking of, it is the perfect Channel 20 movie.
Yes.
So at this point, we rolled the film, and the score for the movie, written by Pino Donaggio, cleverly disarms you in the beginning. During the opening titles, you get this almost goofy music that kind of makes you look at one another and silently ask yourselves, what the hell are we watching?
The soundtrack starts up whimsical, and then it gets really serious. You notice that during the credits? And the serious stuff I really liked. I thought if they carried that tone throughout the whole movie, but it seemed like they were trying to tone it down for some reason.
Well, the thing I like, at the very beginning of the movie, when the credits are rolling, the music is, like, classical cheesy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I was expecting Mel Blanc to come out with, like, Tweety Bird or something. It was that kind of music. And then all of a sudden, you had that attack at the beginning that just sets the tone for the rest of the movie.
If I didn't know that Danny Elfman's first score was Pee Wee Herman, I thought this would have been it for sure.
So we start with five friends on a bright, sunny afternoon drive, and one of their vehicles blows a tire, and the spare needs air. So Woody rolls this tire to the nearest gas station, and just like that, you are teleported from this safe and cozy setting into a horrifying scenario.
Hello?
Hey, can I get some service? Hello?
If there's one thing these films always teach you, it's to never go where you're not invited. And never, under any circumstances, ever, investigate a strange noise.
Ma'am.
Open the door! Open the door!
What'd you think of the beginning there? You know, I thought that was all really well done. Maybe a little bit too much with the mannequins, but just these
the
things
first,
being alive, you're like,
death?
What the fuck is going on?
You mean the opening death?
Yeah. This guy's going in for gas. Mm-hmm. He walks in. No one's around. He hears something in the next room. He goes through. He keeps hearing something. He looks in the room. He sees somebody in the corner. That person's making noise. Hey, what's going on? He goes to check it out. It's a mannequin. It comes alive. Door shuts, window opens, he goes for it, window closed. Everything's rattling around, more mannequins popping up, things flying through the freaking window at him. He actually does what normal people would do. He doesn't do anything stupid. He makes a hole through the door, reaches in to unlock it from the other side.
Right.
Something's got him from the other side.
Poor Woody. His fate is the stuff that nightmares are made of. We'll let you watch the film and find out what happens to him, but don't worry. There's still four more people to kill. And when the three girls decide to take a swim in a local pond, that's when we meet Mr. Slauson.
Howdy. You kids enjoying yourselves?
We didn't mean to trespass. Our friend got lost.
Used to be I'd charge 75 cents a day to swim here. Used to be I'd have 25, 30 visitors a day here. And then the government decided to build a new highway.
That sounds a bit familiar.
I thought I'd better come down and warn you. You all best leave before it gets dark.
Before you know it, everyone's having car trouble. And we find ourselves at Mr. Slauson's old rundown tourist trap where he shows off his amazing animatronics. He seems hospitable enough, handing out beers with big smiles. He even offers to help Jerry fix his Jeep. But before they go, the girls notice a house out back. Mr. Slauson makes it very clear. Stay away from that house.
Eileen.
Woody? Is that you? Woody?
Eileen.
Of course they're not going to listen, and one by one they investigate and find a house riddled with mannequins that seem to have eyes that follow them around. Oh, by the way, Slauson's brother Davey lives there. He likes to wear masks and have conversations with his dummies. He's also batshit insane and likes to kill people.
Woody?
One thing that I really liked about the movie is when the killer is putting on the various masks, how they fit just enough that his eyes were blacked out. Just from the shadowing effect of the mask, I thought that was really neat.
Although the one that creeped me out was the first one, the first Woody one with the hat and that.
Yeah.
Because it actually had like, that, like a tongue and teeth, so it was like a mouth inside a mouth. Yeah. That was kind of creepy.
I brought you a visitor. You're so pretty.
No, please, not again.
Why don't you like me?
What I thought was really kind of off-putting was that you get elements of kind of Michael Myers, a little bit of Leatherface in there, and you get this idea of this kind of voiceless menace being evoked visually, and yet the first time you see him when he's bringing the people into the basement, he's very talkative, and it doesn't seem right. It seems like, wait a minute, this guy's talking an awful lot for, you know, a typical silent, you know, menacing kind of stalking threat.
Yeah.
You know, like, up until now, we've all been, well, not at this point when this movie came out, but going backwards for a modern horror fan, we're used to Michael Myers, we're used to Leatherface, we're used to these people that don't talk.
Well, again, you can see how, what did I say before before we watched the movie? There's elements of Texas Chainsaw Massacre in there, and there's elements of Carrie with the telekinesis.
And dressing up as the female victims as well.
Right.
Yeah.
And not just that, but he had several different get-ups, just like the original Leatherface had a couple of different get-ups. He had the worker get-up, and then he had the transvestite get-up with the lipstick, you know, and the curly, dark hair with the suit that he wore at dinner at the end of it.
Pretty good trick, huh? My brother doesn't like me to do that stuff. He pretends he doesn't even know about my power. But it feels good when I use it. I shouldn't have to hide it. I mean, I can control it. I can. I shouldn't have to hide it. It feels good. But it scares me. Sometimes I really don't know what I'm doing.
How do you survive a foe with a twisted mind who has powers that make him almost omnipotent?
That was an interesting, you know, little pieces of the character like that that were given to you. It would have been enough to just know that this guy was telekinetic, that he had these powers to make things move and stuff like that.
Right.
But he referenced it at one point. I thought that was smart in the dialogue as
well.
Did
going for the key in front of him seated there kind of remind you of Stage Fright?
Well, Stage Fright would have been about 8 years after.
Yeah, but again, a lot of times you can see references to other movies from this. I think this movie may have influenced more than just the makers of Maniac.
Eat your soup. How's that?
Let's eat.
That's what I said. Let's eat. Is it good?
Yes, it's very good.
You want some crackers?
I'd like some more crackers, please.
That's what I said.
Yes, the crackers are very good.
Aren't the crackers good? Oh, I got to fix that.
While I see that this was obviously kind of tongue-in-cheek at times, I can see why a lot of people would like to see it remade, because if this was done in a more serious tone, I think this could really work as a truly terrifying film.
So you think the goofiness to it takes away from any terror?
A little bit. I mean, it has... Well, the problem is every time you get in a moment of goofiness, it has to work that terror back up again, because it loses us a bit.
But then you have scenes like, okay, the scene where he's sitting there and he's telling the girl, oh, you're so pretty, it's a shame you gotta die.
But it won't be easy. You'll die of fright.
and he's telling her, it'll be quick, but it ain't going to be easy, and this is how it's going to go. And he's putting the plaster on her face. Oh, it feels nice, doesn't it? And you can almost feel what he's describing as he's putting it on her.
Oh, you'll never see again.
Oh, you'll never see again.
Your world is dark. You'll never see again. It's getting hard to breathe, isn't it? I'm going to seal the last openings. You won't be able to breathe, but you won't suffocate. Your heart will burst from fright before you lose consciousness. Now, you are one of us. Isn't she pretty?
You're so pretty. Now that, right there, now that's probably the most horrific part of the movie right there. Right. Because it's he's toying with her, too, in a way, and it's just, you know, scene like that, I'm really surprised that it was PG. Like, that's a torture kind of scene right there.
Yeah.
Did you see something?
Shh. Be still and don't fidget so much.
Two people actually manage to escape Davy's basement. They try to be stealthy about it, but then...
You can't get away from me, mister.
That part, I'm sorry, that part I laughed at, like,
honey,
fuck you, girl, I'm out!
Yeah. Oh, here we
are. Consider this a divorce!
The best part is...
Peace, bitch! Well, he tries three doors. How can a place have three doors in 5 square feet? You know, there's a door here, here, and here, and they're all fucking locked. And then all of a sudden, Buddy's like, dun-dun-dun, I'm here and I see you.
That's not even the funniest part.
He's got plaster by a window.
Is after he jumps through when he runs to the end of the deck and then just leaps over the railing. And the way he falls is too funny. It's like he's like perfectly parallel to the ground when he goes over the railing. He's like, come on here!
Eileen!
How could I forget about Molly? Every movie like this needs a final girl, right? That one character who somehow beats the odds, perseveres, and manages to avoid that horrid demise.
Who is it?
That's Molly.
Molly.
Somebody's there. I can hear you.
See my friend?
The only good thing about being special to a maniacal killer is it might buy you a little time. But if you don't exploit that compromise and think fast and fix your situation, you will die just like everyone else. Maybe even worse than them in the long run. So you better fucking do something about it.
A little girl. Mang, he shot me with blanks. Dung, dung, you're dead. Dung, dung, you're dead.
You know what? That's all we're going to give you right there. You know us, usually we have no problem spoiling a movie to hell, only because the titles we focus on are so powerful that even knowing every detail of it will not take away your enjoyment of watching it for yourself. But there are some elements of Tourist Trap that are quite clever, and we'd like for you to be able to experience those for yourselves. And with that, I'd like to introduce our guest this evening. He's the writer and director of Tourist Trap. He's currently an associate professor at the University of Las Vegas, Nevada. Please welcome Mr. David Schmoller.
Hey, David, this is Cash Wampa from Horror 101. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Thank you very much for taking this call and agreeing to this interview with us.
You're welcome. I look forward to it.
We got a few people in here. My crew is Nick, Brian, Paul, and my wife, Helen. We just now finished Tourist Trap. This was the first movie, the full feature movie that you wrote and direct. Is that correct?
That's true, yes.
One thing I wanted to ask you is actually that your movie seemed to be an amalgam of some past horror films that looked like it was really written and directed by a fan of previous works. one movie in particular. I was wondering, is this movie in any way based off of House of Wax?
No, not in any overt way. The film we were probably copying the most was Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Uh-huh.
Which was made in Austin, and it was a lot of the people that I worked on my thesis film had worked on that film. I didn't know Toby Hooper at the time, but that film was really what we were using as our guidepost, because it was a very low budget movie, and it launched Toby's career, and that's what we were looking to do with Tourist Trap. Young people in a car or van or group or whatever, discovering some isolated horror.
What is it about mannequins that interests you so much?
Well, I had done, again, in film school, I had done the first mannequin thing I did I was taking an experimental video class. It was the very first year that Sony came out with a portable video system, and it was on a reel-to-reel. It weren't cassettes yet, but it was just a 30-minute video reel. And I had noticed these mannequins in J.C. Penney's, and they were very, very bizarre mannequins. So if you went into the infant department, the mannequins, the little baby mannequins had eyes and a nose and the mouth was gone, and they had ears. And then if you went into the, you know, three-year-old's department, they had, the mouth was gone and part of the eye was gone. And then, so as they got older and older, they lost more of their features. And this is in the whole store. And so it meant that in every JCPenney, you know, these very stylistic mannequins were, you know, used to display their clothes. So I started filming them, and then I would cut to a human, and I was just sort of, it was like, if this is what's going to happen to the humans, they're going to turn into these J.C. Penney's mannequins.
Mr. Slauson? Can I use your phone?
Well, sure, help yourself. But it doesn't work. I got nobody to call.
Chuck Connors was a big basketball and baseball star. He was known for The Rifleman at the... basically, he was a late 50s Western star. How did it come to he was casted for Tourist Trap, and were there any other choices for Mr. Slauson?
We had about five or six names. I think Dick Young was one of the names on the list. And anyway, he passed. That person passed. These were all actors that would take $50,000 for, you know, 3 weeks' work or 4 weeks' work or whatever it was. And we just went down the list. And the third person, I think, was Chuck Connors, and he accepted.
And, like, he towers over everybody. He's like 6'5", 6'6". Did any of the women have a hard time playing with him? Did he freak them out in real life or anything like that? Or was he a gentleman?
No, he was a gentleman. He was completely, he worked really hard. He really was trying to, you know, revive his own career, and he was hoping the movie would be successful and he would start to get cast as the, you know, new Boris Karloff or something and have a new career as the star of horror films. So he worked really hard. He was intimidating to me. He came up to me one time, I think in pre-production when we were doing, you know, a live, these masks that we put on him. And he suddenly, I looked up and he was standing over me, and he looked down and he said, "Do you want to fight?" He said, "No, why would I want to fight?" And he just laughed.
Most horror filmmakers, especially back in the late 70s and 80s, were begging the MPAA for an R rating, because if it was X-rated or unrated, then they couldn't get released. Yours is kind of an ironic story, where you were surprised to get a PG rating. You think the PG rating hurt the movie in a business sense?
Well, Well, it definitely hurt it theatrically, because at the time, you know, if you wanted to go see a horror film, you wouldn't go, it had to be R or hard R. There was no way you would go see a PG-13, or I don't even know if PG-13 was around then, but you wouldn't go to a PG film if it, you know, if you were looking to go to a horror film. So it really hurt us, and we were very surprised. But ultimately, it turned out to be kind of a blessing in disguise, because of its rating, as soon as it started to play on television, it could play on afternoon TV, and it did. It played a lot on afternoon TV, and that's sort of when, you know, parents would tell their children, you know, go watch TV in the afternoon, so because they were out in the yard doing yard work. And so for a long time, I would get, and I still get it actually, where adults come up to me and say, you know, I was 7 years old when I first saw Thirst Trap on TV, and it scared the shit out of me.
Yes, right here, I was one of them. How close was the final product to how you visioned the film when you first came up with the idea?
Well, that's a good question. It's probably closer than any other film than, except for my last film that I just finished, Little Monsters. And part of that had to do with the fact that Charlie Band was so busy trying to raise money that he just didn't bother us at all.
Charles Band has been throwing money into horror movies for decades. He was a titan at Full Moon. If you remember renting a horror film in the 90s, then you know very well the catalog of great movies that Full Moon produced back in the day.
The only thing that Charlie added, which was completely different in the script, it was a script change that he asked for, the aspect of telekinesis. The original script was much more psychological. And in any moment of telekinesis that you see with the key, that came from, you know, the addition of that was requested by Charlie.
The business side of making a film is sometimes a complex and delicate balance, and because of this, Tourist Trap was almost stuck in production limbo.
Money was just a constant problem because Charlie was really overextended at that point. And we ran out of money, completely ran out of money in post-production. We eventually took home all the, you know, I took home all the work print, which was 35 millimeter of videos, boxes and boxes and boxes of these. I took everything home because, you know, the people were coming to the office and they took all the furniture, and so we had no place to work, and we would still go because they had a sparkless water machine that had a hot water thing, and we would drink coffee, and we were just sort of waiting for Charlie to come up with money to finish our movie, and we finally just went home, and it took him, I don't know how many months, several months, half a year maybe. So that was the hardest, because we didn't know if we were going to finish our movie or not.
What would you say to if somebody wanted to remake Tourist Trap?
Well, people have come to me over the years, you know, asking that question and wanting to do that, but no one has ever come up with the money. I have an option. Charlie actually owns it, and is the only person who could really authorize that. But I have an option to either write it or direct it or produce it or executive produce it. But it's never happened.
I noticed that Ted Nicolau edited Tourist Trap, and Ted went on to make the Subspecies movies, which are some of my favorite Full Moon titles. Yeah. And you made with Paramount and Full Moon the first Puppet Master film as well, which is another favorite of ours. And so I suppose that David Schmoller is responsible for the success of Full Moon that they had in the 90s.
Well, Ted and I went to film school, there were, you know, a handful of people that worked on Tourist Trap that I went to film school with at UT. My writing partner and producing partner, Larry Carroll, Doug Adichie, Courtney Gooding, who was sound man, was UT. There were some people in post, Steve Purvis. It just happens. These are people you go to film school with them, and they move out to L.A., and, you stay friends, and you hire them. Charlie is really responsible for all of the success of Full Moon. I'm very grateful to him for, hiring me for my first film. I was a good director for him. I always, did films within the budget and within the schedules that we had, except for Crawl Space, but that was Klaus Kinski.
Klaus Kinski, a brilliant, gifted European actor, fluent in many languages. He was notorious for halting a shoot with his constant temper tantrums.
Oder sei ich nicht? Und du sagst es mir nicht, aber schreie aber nicht, leg mich doch am Arsch weg. Der Moment ist überhaupt gekommen, wo ich dir in die Fresse haue. Diesmal sitze ich im Kostüm in deiner scheiß Karre in Holland.
He's brought directors to their knees in frustration. And this is who David was forced to work with on a 1986 movie he directed called Crawl Space.
Have you seen my short film called Please Kill Mr. Kinski?
No, and I'd love to get my hands on it.
I just licensed the rights to it to Shout Factory. They're going to put it on they're doing a Blu-ray of Crawl Space in December, and they're going to put, I'm going to do a commentary, and they're going to put Please Kill Mr. Kinski. But the gist of the short is that in the first 3 days of the shoot, Kinski got into 6 fist fights with my crew. And the crew was, he'd never really landed any punches, but he would charge at them and start swinging, and the crew was, tackling and holding back. And he could not control himself. The distributor said, no, you can't replace him, you have to, work it out. And so it was just the whole film was just a complete nightmare every single day with this guy that just couldn't control himself.
Can you tell us anything about Little Monsters? This is a new film that you, I think you wrapped up last year sometime. Has it been going to any festivals? Is it being released anytime soon on DVD?
It's making the festival route. It's been in 8 or 9 festivals. We've won some awards. We've won Best Film. We've won Best Director. And we've won Best Ensemble Acting. Won Best Actor for Ryan LaBeouf. It's going to be available on DVD, which will have all the extras. That will be from our website, which I think is littlemonsterstheMovie.com. And it'll also be available on Amazon. It should be available on both DVD and download rent and download purchase on Amazon by the end of this month.
Can you give us a little synopsis? What's the film about, please?
It's very loosely based on the Bulger murders, which was the story with this real event that happened in England in 1993. In that case, there were 2 10-year-old boys who were at a shopping mall, and they decided to kidnap a little 3-year-old boy. And the reason it made the news was because the image of that kidnapping was on all the cameras, and just seeing these 2 little boys leading this tiny little boy outside the mall, and he was missing for a day or so, and they found him the next day, and the kids had no idea, they had no reason for kidnapping this kid. They were just kids that were looking to, they spontaneously thought, wouldn't that be cool? Let's just grab him.
Since we are based on horror here, can we ask you what your personal favorite horror movie is, please?
Well, that's a good question. I teach the horror film in the summers. That's where I teach at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I'm an associate professor there. And one of my favorite films is Don't Look Now, the Nicholas Roeg movie.
With Donald Sutherland.
Yeah, and Julie Christie. And, you know, some of my students say, well, that's not really a horror film. But, you know, I can make a good argument for it. It's a great horror film. It really is considered one of the greatest horror films of all time. Another favorite is The Audition, or Audition.
The Japanese film?
The Miyake film.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. With the piano wire.
Yes. But one of the films that I saw recently that I thought was one of the better films I've seen in a long time is The Conjuring. I mean, for contemporary films, which tend to be, you know, remakes and not that have not too much interest to me. This one, I think his name is Wan, James Wan. He's such a good director. I think he really understands the genre.
We really enjoyed watching Tourist Trap. Interesting piece of trivia that I found kind of funny. Has your wife ever forgiven you for cutting out her lines from the film?
Well, she divorced me.
Oh. Oops. Moving on.
I mean, it wasn't specifically because of that, but it's actually what's kind of related to that. But anyway, no, she wasn't happy about that at all.
I promised the man this would only be 10-15 minutes, but everyone was having a great time. Around the 1 hour mark, my colleagues were tapping their watches at me, and it was a privilege to have Mr. Schmoller for so long.
We want to thank you very much for taking an hour of your time to speak with us, and we really enjoyed speaking with you, and we look forward to seeing Little Monsters as soon as it's available. We'll make sure we put that in the show as well. Thank you very much, sir. Have a good evening.
You too. Bye-bye. All right.
Bye-bye.
Now, is Tourist Trap any more or less special to you now that you watch the film for the first time and then talk to the filmmaker right after?
It seemed, you know, like we always have this kind of this romantic ideal of the pioneer, like of the rough and, you know, fledgling filmmaker and all the trials and tribulations. But listening to him, it was more businesslike. Like it was more crunching numbers. And when we talk about difficulties during the shoot, it was more about gathering financing, the difficulties on the set. We never really think about that as part of the filmmaking. We think of the more, you know, exciting and interesting aspects, like where you put your camera and about lighting and other things. But we forget about all the business end, and the business end is what makes it possible.
I really like he referenced, and I wanted to expand on that, but he referenced Stuart Gordon films. He loves Stuart Gordon films. That means he likes Dolls, he likes Reanimator, he likes From Beyond.
And of course, the Sunday Afternoon Experience, which I was surprised he brought that up, because that's how we all got into this. It's like he knew what to expect talking to us.
Yep, absolutely. And Stuart Gordon made one of my favorite, outside of the Subspecies and Puppet Master film, Stuart Gordon made his rendition of Edgar Allan Poe's Pit and the Pendulum for Full Moon that had Lance Henriksen, Oliver Reed, and Jeffrey Combs in it. Fantastic movie. Really well done. And Tom Tolles! Tom Tolles plays the captain of the guard.
So how does he die in this movie?
Who?
Tom Tolles. He has to die in the movie, right?
Still badly. Yeah. He dies badly.
Oh, good.
It's time to score Tourist Trap and put it to bed.
Nick, please score it.
To be honest, now that I know what the budget is, too, only... $300,000, even for the late 70s, was pretty good. I'm honestly going to give it 7.5.
Brian Stewart.
I'll match the 7.5. I think, obviously, it's going to... I don't think it'll date well, unfortunately. It's going to seem rather, I think, kind of hokey by today's standards. But at the same time, I enjoy its kind of... the spirit of trying to do something different with its villain. I like the idea that it tried to do bold things, even though it was on a budget. I mean, Schmoller is very much like William Castle. I mean, who both had a real love for what they did. They wanted to scare people. They were putting together movies as best they could with limited budgets and trying to be as inventive as possible to get the shots they wanted. I mean, they really are the kings of really gimmick filmmaking.
Paul B.
I'm going to have to go with an 8. Because it
reminds me of watching those films on Channel 20. And I'm relatively sure I've seen... I don't think I've seen the entire film, but I'm almost positive I've seen bits and pieces of it on Channel 20 or Channel 50 or whatever it was back in the day. And so it reminds me of that. Yeah, there are flaws, but yeah, I enjoyed it. Enjoyed it a lot.
And how about Helen the Nude?
7.5. Okay. And I like it specifically for the opening theme, but specifically because it's not a huge, huge thing as far as big... you know, the whistles and flowers and cherries and all that stuff, but because it's done in 1979, it's something that I think for the budget, for the 300 grand that they did what they could with it, and I appreciate that the fact that they used not a lot of gore, more of the fear factor, but I have to agree with what you said about the comedy music at the beginning. It kind of gives you a false sense of security. You didn't think it's going to be that bad, where in fact it's actually worse than you thought.
It's disarming.
Yeah.
I'll give it an 8 as well, only because it's highly original. Like you said, the villain is something you've never seen before. I think for a first time, like for somebody to write and direct a first time movie, it's a solid production for $350,000. I think the right people gave a check and an opportunity to the right person at the right time, and it's a product of its time.
Oh, you are so pretty. It's a shame you have to die. The party's over.
And that, my friends, is the end of the Tourist Trap Show. Between this film and Maniac, I'm no longer trusting any mannequins. It's just not possible. They're up to no good, I know it. The next time you think one is following you with its eyes, it probably is. Get your hands on the Tourist Trap DVD. Chuck Connors is great in it. It has the stunning Tanya Roberts running around in Daisy Dukes the whole film. She was a Bond girl in the 80s of View to a Kill. Beautiful lady. It also stars Jocelyn Jones, John Van Ness, and Robin Sherwood. We'd like to thank David Schmoller once again for joining us for the show, and be sure to check out his new film, Little Monsters, which should be available at the end of the month. You can check that out at littlemonstersfilm.com. We've got the Big Toronto Con to attend this coming weekend. A lot of horror people are going to be there. Don Coscarelli will be holding a screening of Phantasm 2 Saturday night, and then there's a Q&A. We'll be there. We hope you enjoyed the Tourist Trap Show. Thanks for listening. And for everyone here at the Horror 101 Podcast, this is Cash Wampum saying there's a horror movie out there that's just going to scare the hell out of you. And we're going to help you find it right here at Horror 101, educating your fears.
Finish it off, Mr. Schmoller.
This is David Schmoller, and you're listening to Horror 101. I hope you're enjoying the show, and I hope you listen to it every episode.